Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
bigger picture environment lessons. They're not so much lessons about the environment. They're lessons which teach a small aspect of science that, once understood, then gets folded into a higher level narrative of what's going along about the environment. So there are many aspects. There's political. We have sort of the historical thing about the environment. We have the political feel of the environment, the requirement for young people who care about the environment, the ability to action, the feeling of power. But these environment lessons are for the science classroom to teach a aspect of science, which then folds into a understanding of the environment, slowly prizing them away from what you have is contextual or experience-generated truth. G'day, mate. Okay? I'll give you a bit of context while I'm stopping and saying g'day to people as I'm walking past. Give some context to it. The fundamental thing is that you can learn sort of like you just can't walk through glass, because it's like a force field, and you will assemble some basic knowledge. Nothing to do with the structure of glass, nothing about transparency. You'll assemble a fact profile and it will sit there. And it means that that is good for operational understanding, but that next level of understanding, when someone talks about a glass shortage or danger of glass, you've got to get some more information, assemble it into the situation, and actually build a picture. And so what happens is that, a good example is the Stone Age, for instance. Just talking about glass, everyone knows what stones are. There's stones in the garden, and now we talk about the Stone Age man. So obviously Stone Age man picked up stones as from around the garden, and then you've got your traditional assembled experience generated knowledge, and your experience knowledge of glass. The two don't necessarily go together. But say if you see a cracked bottle or something like that, if you pause to stop, you'll see that the surface of that crack is actually glassy, and it's got these ripples as the force has gone through and the crack has propagated, giving a sharp edge, but also the actual surface in there, it's got these little waves in it. Now, that's just the basic story here, is that it's actually not Stone Age man, it's Glass Aged man. We actually, our most powerful tools were formed out of natural chunks of glass, and we chipped up glass. And this is why I was so excited when one of my students one time said, look, I've got this project, and I'm napping Stone Age tools out of waste glass. And I went, oh, that's great. This person has actually gone outside the traditional knowledge. So you have a traditional boundary of knowledge, like what a stone is, what a cloud is. You know, clouds are where the Care Bears are, and God is, and clouds are water vapor. You know, all these things which are infected wrong. This advanced science knowledge is a bit like a WD-40 lubricant for advanced intellectual thinking. But the story is that it is only something that you understand as necessary if you've ever transcended that boundary. If, however, you have ever confronted a knowledge anomaly, and your basic thing is to, okay, well, I'll bully or white hat the thing and to create a social effect around that anomaly, which maintains that anomaly. So at the end of the day, you have an anomaly, and it creates two groups: the dominant group, who goes with the anomaly, and the subservient group, which is marginalized, who have recognized it. So there's this thing of creating an environment where these scientific ideas come out, and they feed in to the environment narrative, which comes out later on. Now, one of the things I want to point out is that this steering away from taking any sort of risks, taking any, forming any sort of alliance with anyone who's standing up against anomalies, it's perhaps the loneliest positions you can have in a intellectually repressive society, to say, I stand up. So you can imagine Saudi Arabia, if you were to stand up and say, I really think women should drive for all these reasons. And say if you were a man to say that, and you would find that you just would have more investigations, more tax investigations. If you were having a Saudi Arabia barbecue, people would say, well, just please, can't we discuss this? Because it's heavy, it's a big load on us. Can we just shut up and steer it around? So there's sort of a secondary wave of repression. So this is the environment which we're going into, this environmental lessons. These are things that you can experience, which are of the same order and magnitude of a child firstly tapping glass for the first time, or a cat tapping for the first time, and actually speaking to that level and applying a base hypothesis, a non-culturally constructed hypothesis about it. So people's view of clouds, it can be through direct observations, and then there's cultural construction about it. It's cultural, I suppose, deconstruction through through experience. But I do want to go further back, and I'll touch on this a bit later, that there is this fear of anyone ever stepping outside the norm. And there's a fear. So if you say, look, I want to do this, you will suddenly get, if you are in a social media thing, if you say, make a comment that everyone can agree with, relate to, it will go a certain distance. But if you talk about something going against the norm, say quantum mechanics or some aspect of history that is contrary to what everyone believes, yet is supported, it's just a position that could be worked through. If someone joined with you, you could discuss and develop it. It's very blank around there. And this is because it's there's a cultural taboo. So in a sense, the idea is a cultural taboo. I'm going to quickly go back into the context because about this, in terms of cultural taboos and techniques to go forward and things not working. And I suppose the fundamental thing is that if you know the cultural taboo is coming through and you're trying to look at the objective to stuff, you do some basic assaying, or that's testing of things, and you say, well, the response is 5% that's not a good idea and 94% cultural taboo. 95% cultural taboo. Now, the thing is, it's not, we don't have to accept that. We can say, well, perhaps if that 95% wasn't there, we might find some good idea percentages in that 95%. So it's hard to say in terms of idea rational support space, you've only covered a 20th of it. In that other 19 units, which are switched off due to cultural taboo, you might have an opportunity to go through. It's a little bit more complex than that. Now, for those people who haven't tuned in, or this is probably the first time you've listened to this, this is a podcast while walking. I've got this big, hairy, unknown goal of cardiac rehab, and so I've had a cardiac operation, two operations, where a valve has been put in. So it's very much that there was, if you can imagine, some old software. You've got some old software. The computer's crashing. It's going really laggy. And let's call it, for this case, I'm Peter Hill, so we'll call it Peter 1.0. And the idea is at a certain time, it's taking up system resources. As a society or a group, with the failures marking up, we were ready to eliminate it from the system, remove it, and just quietly pop the old, you know, 7.5 floppy disk set and manuals in the bin. It had come to the end of its useful life. It's in the bin. And what's happened is that there's been we can put in a new operating system, make it 64-bit. It was 8-bit before. Make it 64-bit. Get it popping around. And and this is really Peter 2.0. However, what has happened is that the system has the actual operating people, or the people running the system, have said, okay, we're up to the stage that we've removed Peter 1.0, and Peter 2.0 has come in and reconfiguring, but the users don't want to use the system whatsoever. There's this. So it's, I mean, background, you know how when software goes in, it can be for a long time reconfiguring, working out what to do, and sort of an intelligence sort of way, and saying, oh, I'm not connected to the keyboard, the mouse, or anything else like that, let's see how I can integrate with CPU going. So this is Peter 2.0. A new grade of software, which is trying to achieve my software goals, and that, well, I suppose my software goals is to educate humanity. Australia first, obviously, simply because that would be a natural thing to do. But if not, educate humanity, and by analysing, I won't go through there. Things aren't going forward, and the fundamental aspect of educating humanity is nothing too smart. Is looking at the system at the moment, looking at the operating process. So imagine when you hit a keyboard, you type it something in, and there's a big lag. Now, unfortunately, when you type something into your phone, I think your system's become laggy. And so you type something wrong, and then you're working along, and then it seems rather dead, and then a little while later the actual letters come out. Now, in this case, science education is lagging. It's got a lag in it, 100 years, 75 years at least. So there are papers that people published and retracted 100 years ago, and they're still working their way through the system, and they're popping up in our system. Now, what's happening is that people have adapted to their lackey stuff, and that's to them is correct. Now, to the outside observer, that can be fixed. Now, given the way that the operating system, or the Peter 2.0, has been put on the background, I don't have the option to go in there and put a little user message up to the users and say, look, your system's running incorrectly. Please look at this. I can just start to eventually put up applications which sit there, which are obviously operating a bit more quickly. Now, in this lag thing, we want to actually solve the lag thing. And we have the science process, which has been operating. This lag stuff has been gone for the science process. We've said it's no longer useful. We're not going to use it anymore. We have a system of peer review and citing, and if there's something really fundamentally wrong, people can actually say that. It limits that. So there's a quality control in science. Whereas there's a lot more history, wire, constraint, cultural, different class of people doing science education, just the way it is. Again, I don't want to be offensive to people overseas, so we've gone down the track of I'm going to do science stories, cardiac rehab, and now with this cardiac rehab, there is no end point. There's only, or for me, pushing, and then you discover things. So I can increase speed and skill and stuff like that, but it means that I work up to a certain point, and still after an hour or 2 hours, I suddenly run out of energy. And hopefully keep on pushing, that energy frontier will go up, and the quality will go up, and the connections will go up. But I didn't know that was going to happen, so I didn't know what I was pushing for. So a lot of physical things are coming under control. Suddenly the blood pressure and all that type of the heart parameters are looking good, particularly with this exercise physiology there. Sort of picked up one area, and that's moving ahead. But then I realised there's other things that when I walk and go things, I can go here, but it's still a bit puffy. So I'm going to have to push my way through. So in this, there's, if you like, rebooting processes and podcasting while talking. The important thing is to get exercises and brain function going as one of the things, and building up your repertoire or your ability. It takes a lot of effort. It's a hot night, and there's the occasional male, sort of older male like myself, walking around. So that's the context of people. I think that with, well, I don't know, there'd be, if you dig back, you can, if you get into the blog, you can go months back, and you can hear me podcasting while walking, grasping for breath, or at various times, although I haven't heard of it, you can hear me podcast, and then it's only the most recent podcast I've done where I've started out well and slowed down and actually fallen asleep. This is where I've begun breathing really hard, yawning, and just stopping between sentences and stopping. So that's the demon I have to fight against. And so given this system isn't really working, i.e. Peter 2.0 is somehow drawing more energy and putting things into hibernation, I've got to package up the software in, which is, say, the idea content as it's been forming and configuring into systems. And one of the systems which has evolved is being able to podcast into a fairly cheap dictaphone, get reasonable quality stuff, and stick it in the computer and have basically robotic software manage it forward. And I should just remind myself, there's one little bug which I have to go up. So I'm actually very familiar with fixing bugs in robotic software and production. I sort of know the major point at where you can basically promise a product to a customer at, say, 10% of your production, theoretical production value, and then several months later it's 90%,
you're 90% level, but you're only halfway through the amount of work, and then eventually goes down to work comes down to you've got 2% and 3% work to go. And so that's where I'm up at the moment with the software. But that being said, there's the development of the software, so it's got capabilities, and you've got to step back from it from time to time to work out where to develop it. And so the basic podcasting software has been re-engineered for a quiz software, and the quiz software's open up the strategic frontier of where, as you go through on a piece of production equipment, you're sitting there as the person who receives the order, the person who sets the stuff up, gets the equipment out, gets the components together, builds the order, ships it, goes, and initially you do all of those steps, and one by one, as you automate it, you step back. And so one of the things I am looking at the moment is that I've morphed the podcast software into quiz software, and I'm looking at stepping back a little bit, i.e. breaking up the quiz creation process to the expertise, having expertise come in. I've just got my first group of experts in, and crafting it out and learning how it operates, and who will train the experts, who will be interfaced with the experts. It's really a complex thing, and starting to explore forward about who will market it and what will the process be. And of course I had one initial idea, is of partnerships with people who have an obligation to communicate, which is happens to be the Climate Council. So a really long art I've gone through to the Climate Council, and we've gone through a step where I've spoken to them, and then rather than communicating, I've put a product to them, which is a climate quiz, and they've listened to it, and very supportive, but of course, they're unaware of this 1.0, 2.0, which is one level of me, but society in general having a taboo level. They can obviously sense that they are pushing up against this taboo wall, and they have to find themselves as this taboo wall, but they're not getting through. So essentially they're putting through climate policy, which is right, and they're beginning to feel that taboo probe by calling out people who are basically climate zombies, people whose brain isn't functioning. And so there's sort of an allied point there, but there is an understanding that people need the right to interact with ideas and not be pushed too far. The reason is not out of care for them, but you've got to keep them within the negotiation zone. And so their comment was, well, why don't you go with local radio? So I look at local radio. So one of the things they could do is, they have access to experts. The experts could put into the, could work with me, and they could have a product in front of them. But that idea is too far for them at the moment. Well, we have the local radio thing, which is literally in Sydney, probably 100 local radios. So this is a large customer base, and they're basically very close to the position of providing a medium and resources and assembling things to go forward. So there is this potential. So I've just contacted local radio. So this is following it forward. Now, it is relevant to this trying to establish with them the idea of having a radio program assembly process of experts partnering with software, partnering with radio presenters, producing a community knowledge base, which is going to evolve into the future. And so with an audience of 100 people in this space in which they are struggling for significance and stuff like that, that looks to be a good thing. So going through here, I've said, by the way, here, have a lovely green Christmas, and a bit of a thing there. But by the way, I'm a teacher, educator, whatever it is, and I've got some good climate lessons. So it's like scratching your head, no response to it whatsoever. And so we have this process here. There's the main booting of Peter 2.0, the sort of zombie taboo boundary. Well, that's all happening here. But on top of that, there is this world of experience which looks at very strong educational point. Now, if you can imagine this long struggle, although speaking with students over a long period of time, they said they really had the education wasn't penetrating to them. At the end of the day, they were not using the education, but what they would say is, well, it's the one time I was, you taught momentum by putting us on skateboards and getting us to push, you know, push each other apart. And there were certain things, you got us to do this. And I remember that experiment. It was the funnest experiment. So we're getting part of the way there, like that 5% penetration and 95% cultural disintegration. Now, the response to there is to work with the fact that you've got this 95% barrier and move in with the barrier. I'm sort of looking at moving out of the barrier. So we've got these two things, the point that I've developed this podcasting process, and I can actually, and so I've got the process, I've got the cognitive stuff where I'm beginning to access, oh, I generally have to do this, I'm going to have to do a podcast on that point, and I have to exercise. So look, unfortunately, I'm just about to start walking down Glenbrook Gorge, so going down will be fantastic, going up you'll suddenly hear me whisper, doing, but I know to take it nice and slowly if I want to keep on talking. Well, all these things going on leading up to this particular podcast, I'm not sure how many people are going to be listening by this point in time, but it is important to put it into some context, because if I say the base experiment, people will say, okay, this person's telling me about this experiment, he says it works, but let me stick my tongue in my mouth and feel the wind of taboo. And it's blowing around that this isn't going to go anywhere. So you'll have this self-satisfied, oh, I'm not going to listen to that. I'm not going to do that. Then they'll listen to it, and then they'll pick one set of points, and then they'll say, did you do such and such of a teaching standard? And what I, in actual fact, do is get the entire teaching standard, tick it off, and build the lesson. And I actually do things. I take the entire class surveys at the end, record it, scan it, do everything. But I realize now that I've got to, the message is not whether you have done it. It's their way of saying, my taboo programming says I'm a zombie and I'm not going to listen to you, even though you've done all this work. So at the end of a lesson, I will scan it and do a written survey, go through a test, analyze it, data analyze it, and declare, well, this has actually been successful. So this is perhaps a point to say that although this is just a podcast you're listening to, and although it's not officially endorsed, the actual quality ideas going into it, the overall structure, is much higher than the resident available thing, simply because there's this shutdown. So that being said, I think we've got the various things, various threads of why you listen to a podcast that this person doing here, why this person's developing this podcast software, so that it's an integrated approach to developing software to support your rehabilitation up to a higher level that wouldn't be provided by actually going to a teaching institute. They would sit you down for an hour for like the support generated for you is basically to reinforce people's self-perception that they are supporting you. And so when in fact they don't support you, there's more anger. So bypassing that completely, let's build a system, a podcast system, which gets you out there, and build that system into a greater system, which aims at eventually providing lag-free quality. That is, effect goes up, it's instantly available, and experts can actually interact with that fact, get it tuned up in real time. Okay, and to go across there. So you've got all those threads here. So I hope it's helpful. And so one of the first things I want to do is talk about a base experiment in what we called Year 7, when we first people into high school. Now, one of the things we want to do is introduce the Bunsen burner. The Bunsen burner is a culturally icon thing to do. It's got some flame magic going on. It's got a bit of complexity. It's got a process to go ahead. And I'll just, I suppose, talk about the Bunsen burner. So the Bunsen burner is those little tubes with a base and a gas here. And this is a head scratcher in that I don't know, playing around with the Bunsen burner, I worked out how to light and stuff like that. Then I came across people educating people how to light it. And that is, you have your match sitting above the Bunsen burner, then you turn on the flame. And what always seemed to happen is the air inside, which doesn't have fuel mix, will blow out first, blow out your flame, and then the gas would come out, and then people would light again. And what I'd done is sort of knowing a bit about what flame fronts are and things like that, would light the match and actually sit the match just about 5 millimeters below the edge, and the Venturi effect of the gas going up would blow the flame into the main flame. It would light every time. And I thought, oh, this is a bit, that's the way to do it. But however, the testing mechanism is that people were failing. If they were told to do that, it would light every time, but people in the other instruction classes would say, oh, you can't go going across, until I saw on the internet the way to do it was the way that I naturally did it, to go across. So we have the Bunsen burner, and it's a core piece of experiment equipment that we want to go in, because once you have a Bunsen burner, it exists in a particular place in a particular process, it then means there's other pieces of equipment. Once you teach about the Bunsen burner, you have a template for adding more and more in to sort of qualify and develop, and you can give a sophisticated thing, eventually build up this. So rather than, so there's investment there in building confidence, but also creating a literacy in lab stuff. So like with all literacy, you start off with the cat sat on the mat, and get the sort of verb and noun structure going. So there's that sort of thing in literacy. Although you could, the first time, get someone to set up a still, and it'd be fantastic, you would in general have a few breakages. Because there's a few things to get right. One is the placement of equipment on the bench, such they don't break. So and this is a something that you do see, people who've got a very good class, they don't break anything. Someone who's got a poor disruptive class, things are happening because they haven't been trained in equipment placement and stuff like that. They don't know to do that, and so they have say, well, it's not the fact that my training's no good, it's the fact that the class is no good. Now, just as a small aside, the replacement of equipment and stripping it and assembling of things is something is a basic weapons drill. So if you disassemble a rifle, there's a way that you place it down so that you can strip it in the dark and assemble it in the dark and reassemble it in the dark. Of course, I used to cheat a little bit by putting a bit of glow in the dark. Various faint little europium paste. It gets glow in the dark, so miraculously I would it's various things that say and you have to say finished, and what would happen is that switch the lights on and you'd have the assembled rifle and everyone would be, what, how did that happen? Because you've got to, the main thing is that they didn't quite understand why you were closing an eye a while before, because it was a dark adapter. This obviously does happen in the bush when you're going ahead. So there's this entire thing about Bunsen burners, but then there's also a match. Now a match is very, I suppose, important. One is to say what's happening, how there's fuel, there's potential energy, there's processes going on. The wood itself is a of a match, is made of poplar and doesn't have resin in it. So one of the most important things is that if you had a match and you have a piece of wood, what is the difference? One is producing heaps of smoke, and one's not. One's low pollution, is low pollution combustion. A stick burning, you gas the room basically. You've just got a little stick, light it, or a leaf, your smoke goes everywhere. So the match is designed for low combustion, and there is a method of striking a match, and you have to actually basically teach kids how to strike a match. I'll obviously strike it away from you, but there are sort of various things to go. Now, obviously, there's other things that when you are training up kids, and they are really good. Kids are fantastic to train, because if you give a little bit of patter and you do a proper weapons demonstration of how you do it, and they just see you naturally line the matches, the dinner matches, one after the other in groups of five, and it's over there, and you watch it, you will see people pick it up without any saying, and say, particularly girls and people who are really looking carefully at what you're doing, they will say, well, no, you've done it wrong. They will copy exactly. Now, one of the things I want to do is say, what can we do with a match? Now, you can get your beaker, you fill it with water, coolish tap water, let it stand for a while. So you fill it up your beaker with water, you let it stand for a while. So this is a lesson, so please just listen to it at the moment, and we'll talk about it up. So I've put you in the sighting here. You're listening to a podcast of a teacher in 2.0 mode. It's been kicked off, but he happens to be a robotics scientist who can program and is very determined to solve sort of mental knock-around problems, just to push the systems up. So you're listening to that, and he and I've actually been able to progress quietly with my training on how to train, and just confidently go ahead and see where things go. And you're about to listen to your first environmental lesson, and it involves matches, a beaker of cold water, and that is it. There's one other ingredient into it, and again, I've sort of clued you into all these things happening. Look, it is a complex world. It is probably your world. But I suppose the important thing to do is listen to the fact and say, this is something which I can do, it can be done, and I want you to appreciate people's scepticism and negativity associated with this and say, that's not me, that's not this particular freaky person out podcasting late at night and all this type of stuff. It's a cultural thing. If you hear negative response to this, you are touching taboo. Okay. And this sense of taboo is guiding whole many people who are wanting to advance, like the Climate Council and all these people. They're dealing with taboo in a complex way. And of course, Peter 2.0 software, fast turnaround logic is booting up. It will come. Just rest assured, it will come. Don't worry about it. Okay, we're back to Beacon. And you've got something called food dye, food colouring, I think you would call it. And let's say take blue food colouring and pour a little bit out onto a watch glass. And you take a plastic pipette. So these are these little plastic single-ended, basically thin straws, and they have a little pump at the top which you can press down and pull out. And traditionally these should be cheap enough such that you can use it and throw it away. Okay, but not in schools. They save them each time, which is good for the environment. Okay, it's a fantastic thing, and it's probably an environmental lesson to say, you know, what could we do and how we can do it. The major problem obviously is contamination of the chemicals. If you use these pipettes all the time for different purposes, you can, I suppose, to get them contaminated. But you have these pipettes, and obviously we've got the food dye beaker and stuff obviously going to go across. You'll probably need another a piece of towel, or, you know, ideally I liked a cotton wool bud. You know, ideally that was what you want, and I'll explain why. So what you're going to do is you're going to push your pipette in a little bit and take up a few drops of water, and expand your, take your fingers completely off the pipette so it's relaxed, so it's, the pipette's expelled a bit of air and it's sucked in a few drops of dye. Now what will happen is that doing that, you'll have some dye on the outside of your pipette, and it will, can you hear this frog out here? Now this is an interesting frog. Sorry about this, mate, in terms of hearing all these frogs. I'm coming down, and I am hearing this stream, and it's a torrent. So look, I mightn't be going too far this evening. God, coming up, it's rained like anything. It's been sunny today, but it takes a few days for the water to rush out of the mountains, and we in Australia aren't used to this type of stuff. Basically, it will rain 1 week and a month later, because it's so flat, it will begin to flood. Or, you know, if it's really flooding, it will take about a week for the floods to go through, so it may well be that I can't get through this. But we're at this point here, you can hear the frogs, and so much happening, and it's not looking good. And of course, there's going to be a causeway, and it's generally closed down. Okay, so the main thing is that you put it in the cotton, and the cotton has a large, and the answer is, oh, this is really lime ball, mate. So I've just got to size this up. Like, it's only, I'm going to take it carefully here. Because it's not that I'm just concerned here. It's late at night. You're out in causeway. This is, oh yeah, it's okay. It's just a bit down here. I'm walking across this. The thing is that you're at this very low risk place, and you wouldn't want to slip. And so I'm just shuffling across here because, yes, wouldn't want to slip. Because, you know, you're out in the national park and they wouldn't find you. No one would know you're there. So, yeah, coming across. So I'm across that causeway. And it's a fair amount of water, but it's just, just like a millimetre of water across the bridge, and I was able to walk across it there. And the sort of the worst thing is, after a few hot days, and that millimetre of water, it comes to slime. It's really slippery, but that took a bit of judgement there. Okay, so we've got so you're having a real adventure here, aren't you, mate? Okay, so we've got this drop, and the aim is, with still water, to deliver those drops of water to the bottom of the beaker. You have to very carefully lower your pipette into the water, and then at a period of time when it's at the base, gently squeeze it, the water, in, then lift it, so it's on the base, squeeze it in, not hard, so it's got to flow very gently. So take your time, take about 3 seconds to put it in. Then you've got to raise it up half a millimetre, you have to detach your dye from your dye bubble. There's different ways of doing it, but at a certain altitude, your dye will be wicking up into the area, and you have to release your water a bit more to get water to wash in. It will break the dye, and then you will have to ever so gently lift it up. So if you put it in quickly, out quickly, you'll stir the things out. You'll still get the effect that's there. And I'm going up the other side, doing it nice and slowly, sort of half steps at the moment. Okay, so you now place the pipette down. Now the important thing to do is have your watch glass pipette arranged down so it looks like you're laying out a weapon. You know where the places are. Now at this point here, you have your thing, and you then instruct that you're going to lift up and heat the underneath of your beaker to the count of 7, which is 3.5 seconds. But it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I don't think you can time that way. That's 3.5 seconds. And you will record 3.5 seconds, because you only record, you in procedure you say you count to 7, but the recording says heated seconds, and try to be about half a millimetre across. Now what happens is you will light your match and hold your beaker up very quietly, heat it for 7 seconds, move the match away, put the beaker down. Now assemble the matches down the bench with the dead match next to it. So every time you use it, the dead matches are next to each other. So you can see who's been using the matches, how much, but then you can clean up really quickly, efficiently, for it. Now, what will happen is that the heat will go into the bottom of the beaker. There will be a bit of carbon coming up, carbon black. So even that small thing, you can show clean burning, dirty burning, and the fact that carbon, the match is producing a vapor of hydrogen and carbon, and this carbon vapor, okay, people say, oh, it's really a gaseous mix of carbon, and if burning process doesn't go through fully, you'll be left with tiny little soot particles going across here, and it's these soot particles which cause the glow of the flame. So that's an important aspect to go ahead, and it's important later on. So you place it down, and so your heat island will go across, and the heat will travel through the glass over a couple of seconds, probably 5 seconds easily. You'll be down, and you will watch the flask, and what will happen is a plume of dye will rise up like an atomic bomb from the center. Just really small. It'll be 5 millimeters and will go up to the surface and continue up as the hot air begins to flow. And this is a important theme in that what happens. So this is observe, and what you've done, there's a bushwalker across the other side of the gorge. I can see their light, and can I say that's a recipe for breaking your leg at night, if you use a light at night, you got these shadow. Oh, listen. Okay. I don't know. It depends what sort of track you're going on. But I don't know. I always find it a bit more dangerous to have a light, because you're shining a light in other people's eyes. It's just absolutely just a cataclysm happening. Okay, so this is our first experiment, and it starts to relate to the environment. Clear burning, carbon underneath, a plume going up, and what happens is that when sunlight hits water, the hot air plumes up, but also water vapor is lighter than air, and that plumes up. Now, water being lighter than air, and where clouds are, you're starting to break the cultural, some of the cultural ideas. That's what we're really aiming for, and we're not aiming to educate them on simple facts. We're aiming to educate them on the ability to take on information, step back and question their programming. Now, which is different from the philosophy of identified programming, saying my programming is more dominant than yours, and actually push people across, and then if you can't be programmed, you're not up to everybody else. Create attention and stress. There's a sort of a general calmness, a calmness going in here. And so they will observe it, and testing different colours, and repeating it, and testing different times is great to go ahead. That activity can be quite a great, exciting activity. Then you can call back on how you could shape it into an experiment. Now, what I want to do is just continue on this front for things I would like to test. I would like to do this test with glucose syrup. I massively increase the viscosity of everything involved, and what I'd like to do is go through, and you can do an immediate experiment by putting just food dye at the bottom of glucose syrup. Okay, it's bloody expensive, so you can't get everyone to do it, and obviously glucose syrup and beakers. So if someone spills a beaker of water, says to clean up, glucose syrup is another thing, so it's something for you to look at. And I haven't done this. However, if you are to put just your food drop dye underneath this glucose syrup, that will be much higher density, and that drop will automatically get raised and pushed up. So what you need to do is get your clear glucose syrup, clear glucose syrup, and want to actually your clear glucose syrup. So you want to mix up some glucose syrup with some heavy duty food. Then what you really want to do is circumvent the entire process of having to go down. It's really great being able to go down, go in. That's a very complex process. There are these you've got two things. You can have these fine tubes. Now, they're sort of like the best source of small diameter tubing is tube which is the insulation of the wires. So you get some wire, if you strip some wire, you've got some fine tube, and depending on what the tube is, attach that tube such that it terminates at the bottom of an empty beaker, and you can position the tube in with a little dab of hot melt glue. The hot melt glue does definitely stick to glass, so that's the most important thing. And if you put it through an angle, so at the corner of your beaker, you put it through an angle, it will stay there. Now, the hot melt glue will adhere to, the interesting thing is that your wire insulation is a fairly, it's not your standard plastic. And so, unless you get some products from China, okay, even the products from China doesn't have it. If you heat the jacket. So we're talking about to get a very fine jacket. If you heat it, it will go wax light and shrink and move away rather than catch fire, which is one of the things there. But some of my favourite tubing is Teflon coated tube from hookup wire. And you can't buy hookup wire now. I don't know what's going on. Well, it's hard to do it. So this hookup wire, there's a little gun where you thread, basically gun, you stick it into the gun, press once, it strips it, steps through it, puts it through a needle, and then you trigger it again, and it winds it in a loop coil down your piece of electronics. I haven't seen that for years. However, that wire and hookup wire is Teflon wire. And of course, nothing sticks to Teflon except especially 3M Teflon glue. But again, you can inject this wire so that you can have your ability to create something which will grow a small bead of sucrose. This is called sucrose. Stuff, glucose. I don't know what that is. This you can buy it in the supermarkets. This basically colourless sugary syrup. And the point there is that if you introduce it correctly, you can get this to go at a much more slower pace and do other things. It's not going to mix. can create the same thing, and you can create the top layer. You can actually create a little electric heater. So you apply the electric heater for a while. So this is just a few coils of copper wire at high current. And what happens is you small wire in, a few tight turns, that the increased temperature means that you're going to have increased resistance over an area. And so you don't have to do anything big. You can make a little electric heater here. And this is a great thing because you can get this to happen at very slow motion. It's a worthwhile demonstration. But we can't stop there. What's really good to do is that you can now... what you want to do is... because it's hot, so viscous, you can gently start heating the surface layer. So what you really need to do is get a small, low-powered hot air gun. It's not your massive heat shrink gun, but a hot air gun. And just blow the surface of this. Create a temperature gradient at the top. And what you will see in this exercise, and it will take a fair amount of time to go up, that the your plume will go up in slow motion, but be highly precisely controlled, because your diffusion, your just general molecular diffusion, which is really, really slow in water. Yeah, this is one of the major things, is that molecular diffusion is extremely slow, especially with your diamolecules. If you've got large diamolecules, they don't diffuse. But in sucrose, you won't get there. Now, this is one of the things, one of the faults that people often do. The Smarty experiment. We put a Smarty on paper, and you wet it and let the dye travel out. Well, the Smarty, you put it there. Smarty has to dissolve sugar, and the dissolved sugar creates a pressure gradient, so you don't get true diffusion. It looks like diffusion. A lot of people are told that. But the thing with this is that you'll get beautiful precision, and if you can arrange a temperature gradient, your hot plume will go up to a certain altitude and form a cloud band. All this very important thing to look at how heat is moved in the environment. And of course, your heat from cities, power stations, and the like, to go through here. So this is a important aspect to go ahead here. Now I'm going to take two bands of experiment from here. So that concludes that overall experiment. I've got many kilometers to walk, so this is going to go one hell of a long time. And I have, I don't know, perhaps it feels like infinite number of key experiments to do. So that concludes that. Now, with kids, if you have a science club, you can say, experiments are open. You can use any equipment that you want to the science lab, but you have to explain what you're doing at the time, and we'll safety check it so you can do it. So this is great. Great to go ahead here. And there's several aspects that you want to do. And this is a basically a next thing you want to do is basically get a plastic bottle and a smoke machine Well, I've got one from Aldi. I've got to get some more smoke powder. And essentially what you do is you fire your smoke machine into, there's certain things I'd like to do for the environment, but, is to, is to actually, create a vortex. So you suck in smoke. Now, one of the things you can do is have a hole in the flap with the, sort of a hole at the bottom with the flap, so you can open it up and basically the smoke goes on the inside, pull it out and the flap goes forward. So this is if you can imagine, you get your bottle with the soldering iron, you cut a flap with two holes in it and perforate it such as it's flexible, and then tape on the inside to make sure you can cut it out and make it a flexible flap. So it goes, you can inject it and go out. There's something I built and it worked rather well, but with many of these things you can't really put into mass production. But then, if you squish the bottle, you will blow a smoke ring. And I suppose the idea is that you have these smoke rings going around the classroom, and they can actually go a fair distance. There's this awe and wonder about it, but it gives the idea of a region of gas with certain held in by conditions to go across. We've got a long way to go. So that's just the smoke ring. Now, I've talked a bit about it, the temperature inversion. The next one involves, so we've got the convection plume, a little atomic bomb in a beaker. We've got the smoke ring. And now we've got a simple experiment, which, and the aim of all is to ignore the cultural pre-programming. It's good to get them aware of the cultural pre-programming, but aim in lower. Now, and if I can say, if you've had any experience like me, now I should explain that besides being an army instructor, I was an explainer at the National Science Centre. So I had lots and lots of practice working things through the objective here, some good explainers to learn from, some experts. So that's what you're aiming for. However, that being said, we've got the reinforcement in other areas. You're very much aware that when you enter the school environment, all innovation is off. Really, nothing new is allowed. So, so what you're doing, you've got your syllabus, and if you are tackling, you tackle students' ability to learn science at the expense of them, quote unquote, learning the appropriate science for the tests. So, you've really got to say, do a deal with them that we can do this if we achieve the external goals. Okay, so this one involves simply a beaker of water, and a test tube of water. Love doing test tubes. Now, can I warn you against? There's Pyrex. There's test tubes and test tubes. It's basically Chinese test tubes. Okay, I think they come from China. And they're made out of soda glass, and basically you can't heat them up. If you heat them up, they will crack. and chart, and they break into very small components. So just be warned of that. So for all this type of stuff, you go across. Now, again, the entire purchasing process, you don't get in. So you got to be aware of that. So a professional test tube, you can heat up, okay? But you can't do that for one of these Chinese test tubes, because they will just shatter. And I don't think it's China in general. People want to get bulk value, because these things just break like anything. And you get beakers and things like this, which just blow up, because they're not Pyrex, they're not designed to be heated. They're display beakers. They're mock beaters. Now, in this tube, you can, of course, put a little one of the things you want to avoid is something called Conti's crystals, which is potassium permanganate. It's a really powerful oxidant. It will get in your eyes, it burns your clothes, it's just nothing. So if you want a dye tracer, solid dye tracer, you just buy powdered dye. You can buy powdered paint dye. It's a such thing. And just use that. Just as effective, but sort of non-toxic, not a dreadful chemical. However, now with the dye stuff, you can, there's a way of pouring liquid into a test tube such that it doesn't crack up or break up. So what we're doing? Here is, you get someone to hold the bottom of the test tube and with a match heat up the top of the test tube. And what will happen is, with a match, you'll get the carbon coming across, which is a good thing. But after one or two matches, the water will boil in the top couple of millimetres of your test tube. And this is, and you won't be able to feel it. And this is teaching you that in terms of environment, air is a very good good insulator. And if it's not moving air, it's a very good insulator, or water. Now, just as a little bit of an aside, so you've got hot and the water underneath doesn't mix up. And so this is just an aside, a very important aspect of experimental reactor design. You have your reactor bathed in water and you just want to observe the reactor and get things from above. What you do is that you can have no lid on your reactor. You can just have a layer of hot water, and it means the heat generated from the reactor doesn't mix above, and you get no radiation, no radioactive byproducts leached above. So if you're looking at an experimental reactor, this has come across. Now, the importance of this experiment, so they'll be able to hold the bottom of the test tube, and it can be hotter up. Now, what happens is this happens with Earth. Rather than a match, it's UV light, which has been absorbed by the ozone layer, heats up this top layer of the atmosphere. And it means that the bottom layer, when the bottom heats up, forms your plume and stuff, mixes, and the top layer doesn't mix. And so we have two layers of atmosphere. The bottom layer on Earth, the Earth heats up with a little radiation which goes ahead, and it creates convection, all these things. And above it is your top layer, which doesn't mix. and you will see that your clouds go up to a certain stop and they stop mixing and they don't go up to the stratosphere. Now what happens is that jet aircraft go up into this area, which is the stratosphere, which is, the stratosphere is 10 to 50 kilometers up, and this is a temperature inversion. That is, the temperature of the stratosphere climbs above that of the temperature of the top of the stratosphere, meaning that the hot air in the stratosphere is not hot enough to continue rising. Sorry, that's the stratosphere, the troposphere. And this is your next major wake-up call, is that then you show them clouds, and you see the clouds go to a certain height, and that is they're sitting on a layer of invisible water vapor, which you've got to go, and then they go up to a certain height, and then they stop, because there's a temperature inversion. And so you can actually see the ozone layer is that stratosphere layer. It's the layer of atmosphere essentially going up to perhaps 50 kilometres more. I'm sure it's more. I think 75 kilometres. And it's going up. And it just has to be a little bit hotter than the stratosphere for this to go on. Now, is this teaching environmental morals? Is this actually teaching people to write letters of protest? No, it's not, because that's contaminated space. You are competing with people who essentially are much more interested in teaching traditional teaching and the way it's always been taught. And then as a second thing, they might get on to teaching environmentalism and stuff like that. So that's the main game. So you're not going to have any success teaching environmental ideas, because the education system is essentially about teaching the way education is taught. You, the main aim of the education system is to produce more teachers. Okay, so like the, I remember when I was at Xavier College, Jesuit College, when there were Jesuits there, and the Father Phil Walbridge, I think he's now defrocked or put aside for various reasons, but not, I don't think he was the same for pedophile reasons, but he sat back and said, look, Xavier College is the reproductive organ of the church. At the end of the day, out of this cohort of 300 people, or what, 200 people, been close to 200 people, we want to produce so many Jesuits, because, you know, if we don't do that, this is, we're not going ahead. And so essentially you've got to recognise that the education system is about reinforcing its norms and values and creating conforming people who will continue to teach the same stuff year in, year out. And what we're doing here is saying, being silent on that front, because you don't want to poke the bear, and introducing things. These are a series of experiments where you say, you've done this, you've developed your confidence, and hey, look around the place, and go ahead. And that series of steps will allow you to go ahead. So this is very much important with the sucrose version, to create that temperature inversion. Now, there's a few important aspects here. I think greenhouse gas is a reasonably important thing to go in. But this is something that you can say, that the temperature really drops down again. Why does it drop down? I'm still going gently uphill around here in the night. There's a pass. There's a volcanic crater off to my left, and I won't go down that because the track is very dusty. it's nice and quiet, and you're in a national park, and fortunately I'm super healthy. Before, if I did this before my heart operation, that would have been a tad risky. Okay, I've just got to get it going. So, why does the temperature get colder as you go into outer space? Well, what do you know is cold? An ice cube is cold, a fridge is cold, a cold room is cold, and essentially, one of the important things to do is get the idea that the space, the room of space, has got really cold walls. That is, the walls of space, the black of space, is 2 degrees Kelvin. It's minus 71 degrees? 273, 271. Got it again in my head. This is all this data I'll record and reboot my brain. It's very cold. And why is it cold? Well, essentially, we're talking about environmentalism, and if you can't say space is cold and we've got to chill out into space, that's an important thing. The sun is like an oven and we've got to cool to space. This is an important thing to do with greenhouse gases. Now, your big thing is, well, how does something get cold? And now you've got to be really careful here in that any spray can that you spray will have allergic reactions. However, and again, what's really cool is you get those little carbon dioxide canisters for drinks. You can't anymore. You can't get it in Australia. Those little carbonated balls, those carbonated little tubes of carbon dioxide, you can't get that anymore simply because of, simply because it, people put them in guns, air guns, and they're made in terrorist explosives. You can't get them anymore. Or you can get them under license. But it's one of those things that are good to go because they can actually freeze. It's got old extinguisher. The old gas extinguisher is a good thing to go because you expand that and you can feel it's quite cold. So I'm sure you can think of different things. One of the things is that you can get something and pump it up under high pressure over a period of time, and then just release the pressure and it will chill down. And essentially, that's what space has done. Space has expanded, and as it's expanded, the energy intensity, the same amount of energy is in space, except it's now massively expanded, so it's now spread out, so it is much colder. So that's an important point. But what we have said is, well, look, liquid does not transport heat very well. Gas is okay. If it's hot here, it will stay there for pretty much ever. So what's going on? And this is an important point to get across. The greenhouse gases radiate out heat. They absorb radiation. They re-radiate in all directions. But as your greenhouse gas gets into really high the upper atmosphere, your CO2 in particular, that small amount of CO2 starts to radiate out heat. So you get something called a thermocline. That's going up. The entire thing is that you're building up. And in the short time is that you have bypassed the tragedy, which is known as the ozone layer. And I think I did this in the quiz. People think you layer on your makeup, you know. You layer on the foundation, then you layer on your blusher, all that type of stuff. It's not like that. It's basically like a cake. The flavour is distributed in the top section of the cake. It's a layer of flavour, but it's not a distinct layer, like a layer of jam or something like that. It's to get across. But the carbon dioxide, has got it. You get some carbon dioxide, and it will radiate, because that's what it is. You bounce it around, it picks up a bit of, so you put infrared heat into it, infrared light into it, it'll absorb it, it'll bounce around it, and it will heat the surrounding atmosphere. Then, on the opposite thing, it will, if it's the surrounding atmosphere is hot, it will bounce around and radiate out the heat. So the important thing is that your carbon dioxide is causing thermocline and thermopause. This is Klein's a slope, a thermocline slope, and a pause is a change in conditions. So I think the tropopause is the top between the stratosphere and the troposphere. And then you've got your thermocline, and then you've got, after that, it's a thermocline that gets cold. It would, if it could, go down to the temperature of space, but the sun's very powerful light. This is the light which oxygen and nitrogen is absorbed, goes in there, and that really packs a punch, and the temperature goes up again to meet somewhere towards the temperature of the solar wind, wind going up. So that's a important aspect there. Now, one of the things is that one of the points you want to sort of make is that you're learning one system. So what's happened is they've learnt their infant system, which people have not taken as a system of infinite thought. And so what they'll do is they'll take one system of infinite thought element and reinforce it and build with that infinite thought, they'll try and build across from that infinite thought into a science, a dumbed down science, which is built with infinite thought. And obviously it can't move anywhere, and it's absolutely dangerous because it reinforces the infinite thought. You haven't actually taught the person to self-analyze and question. Now, one of the things that I want to point out now is that this next thing, which is to do with a density gradient. So we can sort of defeat convection by actually just applying a hot heat source at the top. There's not much to it here. But what I want to do is say this is the Earth system in a way of getting forward. We're going to do the global conveyor. What the heck? Sorry, I'm just listening. Okay, there's some sort of snake around here. It's trying to pick it up. So it's reasonably hot, so this snake's about. that's listening. Okay. Right, so you've got to be on your guard. It's a reasonably good moonlit night, and there's sort of no risk of stepping on a black snake here. You're staffed. Now, one of the things one of the things you would do, you want to apply pressure to it and piss off. You wouldn't worry about the black snake, but you then stay still and call in the cops that hate the living bejesus out of you for it. I wouldn't say anything. Back here we're going to do the next experiment, is build the sun. Now, the important thing is that the centre of the sun, although you see the surface of the sun has heaps of weather and convulsion, that kind of goes down to after a third of the sun, that stops, and it goes, the sun becomes really a solid. That is, it behaves like a solid. A bit like an ice cream or a jelly. You put a little marker in there. That marker's going to stay there for God knows how long, hundreds of years, millions of years. Nothing's going to move on. There's no movement certain down. So really the sun has got sort of like an atmosphere. Well, it's got this big atmosphere, but it does have this, what we call like an ocean effect of convection. And underneath it, it's really all still. And so what you want to do is put salt at the bottom of a test tube and slowly drip and add water. The idea put incredibly saline solution so that you can get water which is at saturation. And the way that you do it is that you get a magnetic stirrer. So most schools have magnetic stirrers. This is a beaker with a magnetic beam, and the magnetic field rotates going around. Okay, so I'm just super sensitive to listening to inside the bush to hear. You can hear snakes. Okay, it's quite easy to hear a snake, especially in this weather. They make this very distinctive rustling sound. Okay, so what I'm hearing is probably insects at this stage. Okay, so you keep on adding salt until it doesn't dissolve. You have to keep on stirring it, and so it takes longer and longer to dissolve. So the last bit of salt you put in will take a good old minute to dissolve. Now, one of the important things is that salt, when added to water, I don't know why it goes, you've got to be aware that there's this. In Australian salt, they have an anti-caking agent. There you go, an anti-caking agent. There's this white crap which goes in your normal salt. And I've really forgotten the process of getting that white crap out. You can either buy reagent-grade salt or there's a few processes to go to get rid of this white sediment that essentially you've got to stir up your salt, let this white sediment go out. This is only small stuff. I don't know whether it's small nanoparticles of salt or what it is. It's this white component. So you get your clear salt. So either you put it inside the test tube and build it up that way, or you pour it into the bottom, and on top of that heavy salt, you pour in, drop by drop, fresh water. So the fresh water will sit on the top of this, and you'll have at the bottom of your test tube a little packet of salt and salty water, and above it low density. So you've got a density gradient which is going to fight a thermal effect. So in this case, you get your match and you heat your test tube. Now, what is amazing at this point in time is that as you heat it, the students will suddenly make sure that they're holding it properly. As they heat it, they will touch it, and at the top, what the heck was that? Okay, it's getting a little bit spooky here. They'll touch it, and it will suddenly start to quake, vibrate. And so what will happen is that the salt water will, because it's not convecting, the temperature, the heat is not moving, the temperature will go right up and create a quake. It will turn to vapor, instantaneously move a small distance, go to colder region. You won't even be able to see the bubble. It'll go up and the bubble will collapse, and essentially these bubbles collapsing when they reach the cold water is the sound of boiling water. So sound of boiling water is bubbles imploding as they go to colder areas. Now, the important aspect for this is that you saying that one of the things that you do get in this process is that you don't get heat transport out of the sun. You get a huge temperature gradient driving energy out. And this means that this lack of mixing in the sun reason that the sun's core goes up to such high temperature. Alright? Okay, does that make sense? If heat was being transported to the sun efficiently, it would be very hot for a short time and cool down its core. It's this process that the heat is going out there. Now, what happens is that this solid region shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. So in dwarf stars, it's only small, so you get this huge turbulence. So this is why small dwarf stars, the solar weather is so, it's mostly weather, it's a small region which is there, in a way. Then even in really huge stars, the process swaps over again, you get a turbulent inner core. So it's, sort of a inner way of talking about solar physics, but it allows you to start to say that the heat of the sun is generated in the centre of the sun. The heat transport is it's called radiative transport, but it is effectively conduction, heat conduction. That's the way heat moves in glass. So if I hit a rod of glass, it'll be hot on one end, it won't be a good conductor, but it will conduct. And this process of conduction is photon transport from one part of the substance to the next. So you've got all that to go across. And so this is part of the stuff that, as you can see, you've got two paths. You can say, I'm running a a thing on an environmental thing. I want to teach about environmental science. It's really important. You go through the entire politics and you basically educate students. Like there's one page educating them about groups and history and society and feelings and views, and no one's got a view, no one knows what's thinking. In fact, you don't know what you're thinking either. There's sort of no critical view. Everyone's allowed to have their own opinion. It's lovely world, we're offending no one. And of course, the science lab is not that. The science lab is, have this experience. Can you explain it? You are actually teaching self-education. So it's, if you can imagine, I do know environmental units, and people have to write an essay and explain diagrams, and that's a multiple choice. But this is very much different from the cool science experiments which go through on it. And therefore, we're talking about earth science. What are you talking about? Stuff above the troposphere? No. Well, yeah. Why are you talking about the stratosphere? Why are you talking about the thermopores? Why are you talking about space? The fact that space is cold. Why are you talking about the sun? The heat is caused in the centre of the sun. Why are we doing all that? And the answer is, I can tell you, you're wrong. The fundamental thing is that if you teach basically how things work and self-critical evaluation, you're wrong. At the end, let's have a vote on it, and the hands go up around the table. You're wrong. End of the story. And that's it. But you can assess it for yourself, these great little experiments. So now the major point is that as you're going along, if you're not testing whether people have understood it and integrated it, you can have people with too much information too quickly. They really have to be self-guided. And so if someone has, say particularly, has tutors, they're in year seven, and they've been tutored to get into school, and tutors, if you say something that the tutor doesn't know, or it does not correspond to it, you will have external forces working against you. So, now, the result is, depending on what country you're in, you may find yourself in a country which can go ahead, and good luck, because you're going to be at the cutting edge, moving across, and when you're kids are successful, the rest of the world over a period of time will start saying, what are the factors here, what are they doing, and you will get here. And can I say that essentially there's authentic experiments which work because of the science, and there is authentic explanations because they correspond to our universe. They don't correspond to an educator's construct. So let's go up to here. We've got our gradient of salt, and we've got the idea that the amount of salt in it here increases the density. However, temperature increases, makes it expand, reduces the density. So those two things are fine. What if we could do is set up an experiment in which I could get those two things to balance? Hang on. What exactly are you talking about? Well, what I do is that I have a beaker of fresh water here, and I have a beaker of slightly saline green water, which has got a green food dye, a beaker, and I heat this beaker up to a reasonably high temperature, not such as boiling. Now, one of the things that you could do in this is have a small amount of salt in here, and you heat it up and evaporate it up, increase the salt density as you drive the water off. Important that you do this. Then you have your pipette, your plastic pipette. It's reasonably good, or a glass pipette. Glass pipettes are a bit dangerous for kids. That's year 7 kids. Okay. And you have it sitting in there. The important thing is you don't want to have a cold pipette, because the important thing is you've got to draw that up, that hot liquid up, and you are going to drop it ever so softly on your fresh water. Okay, and what will happen is, because it's, if you get it sufficiently hot above the saltiness, it will stay, it won't mix with the water. So you've got to be careful, but you will get a layer of hot, salty water sitting on top of the fresh, fresh water, and you'll see it there, and you get people to observe it, and you don't say what's going to go on, and they'll be observe it for a while, and someone will cross, from across the room, will say, "Hang on, my surface layer has suddenly flipped over and is starting pouring down, So the temperature will equilibrate, and it will go, it will cool down and suddenly become cold and dense, suddenly plunge down, and you will create a salt inversion. Okay, so I'm just quiet here because I've just heard something in the bush off the side here. There's strange here. There's no kangaroos or anything in the bush. It's really quiet. I can't work out what's going on. I don't know. Listen. There's some sort of animal out there. What you can definitely hear wombats. Wombats firstly make a snorting sound, and they make a lot of noise. And there's a bit of a background noise. Yeah. So you've got this thing happening, and the students will say, "Oh, what the heck's happening here?" And therefore, what will happen is that without explanation, other people will see what's going on. And they will, at this stage, you've trained them up, and they've got the procedure down pat. They've got a series of things going ahead. They know that they've got the structure of convection, temperature, gradients, all this type of stuff. They begin to get across, and you will essentially get students starting to self-educate each other and come over. And the entire thing is, because it has only happened one, they will look at the others to go across, and by and large, it will all happen. It may not happen in some people's experiments, and what will happen is they'll ask why, and it will be diagnosed as sort of this natural process. Now, once this is all done and dusted, you then open up the discussion or the explanation to the global conveyor, and that is the most classic one. It's United States centred. You get a lot of temperature heating up this basin, which is the Gulf of Mexico. Heats up, the water evaporates in the hot tropics and stuff like that. You know, lots of rainfall, and this basin, the Gulf of Mexico, becomes salt and this hot water gets trapped in a stream of water and forms a big river, 10 times the size of the Amazon River, and transports heat energy in the surface layer. So this salty surface layer sits on the top of the Arctic Ocean, goes up in a process, and heats up Europe. So Europe is hot, this Arctic conveyor, and this transports heat energy up into the Arctic Ocean. And what happens there is that it heats all this area. Now, instantly, there's no glaciers forming in Europe or anything like that. And we can sort of discuss how glaciers form and all that type of stuff. It goes up to Antarctica, cools down, and does what it does in your beaker. It starts to descend. And again, you have to be really careful to monitor that you don't overload your students. But once you can get this self-teaching going on, you can get a gradient of learning and communication in your students. And so they've done the global conveyor. It works absolutely, absolutely beautifully. And so as the water plunges down, it actually, as it plunges down, it sucks, or it displaces the water as it travels downwards and pours down. And so this heat engine is pumping the world's ocean. And this is important because doing this mixes nutrients. So your plant life is at the top of the water. And this goes here, and this pushes the stuff, and so puts nutrients right throughout the ocean. And it takes, I think, several thousand years for the water to actually snake around. So if I had a bottle, which wasn't floating, but just water neutral, and I threw it in at the Gulf of Mexico, I would come back in year 2600, and at that time that bottle, say if I was in, what was it, 1592, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Okay, so if I was 1600, I'd be at the year 2600, and that that bottle, which is not near floating, just neutral density. Now, the important thing is that if you talk about that idea, the neutral density of bottle, people will say, well, no, that bottle will start to float a lot in the because the water surrounding will evaporate. So that's a good thing. But to give an idea of it going across, so you've got the global conveyor and the world's atmosphere. And so essentially, I suppose the major point to do is to the realization that your actions affect the outcome of the experiment. And so what we are saying environmentally is that we are conducting a massive experiment on planet Earth, and there is no other. It's the only one going on, and we are selecting things, and it's our ability to say things, to say what's going to happen. So you'll get a range of outcomes. Okay, this is important things. So you get a range of outcomes happening, so that's theory, and the theory of adding increasingly complexity, and you start off of what level of understanding do I need? Well, you need a level of understanding which has sufficient complexity to match the complexity of the problem that you're coming across. Okay, that's unfortunately what's necessary. And it's nothing against you, when you look at Trump and climate deniers, it is not that they're, or they are wrong, but they don't have sufficient complexity. And they are, in actual fact, interested in doing pretty much what the education system is doing, is the cultural DNA. They have a social system which wants to replicate, in the case of teachers, produce more people in the education department who are capable of teaching teachers to teach. If you actually look at teaching teachers to teach by teachers, at no point does a scientist get a look in. And similarly, in your environmental thing that you've got control of the taboo nod, you haven't done anything, you haven't broken any rules, you've just made nature witness. But the idea is that it's all about, that taboo thing that you're going across, it's all about society generating people to maintenance a taboo. They're quite amazing. That is, if you look at Donald Trump making logical reason taboo, and people can say, well, I'm going to stand up and I can miss out. But it's like it's group thing. You need a solidarity. If you've got someone saying, I'm prepared to have a fasting contract and not act with integrity, but get all the money and all the power. So the Faust is this person wanted something, and to do it, he had to sell his soul. And that selling the soul, at least as far as the moralists are concerned, doesn't cause this great tragedy and this thing. Now, unfortunately, one of the things that you, when you sell your soul to not act reflectively and rationally, one of the things that you jettison is the need. You sort of lose your sensation of soul. It's not that they've lost their soul. Yes, they have lost their soul, but they've lost their sensation of soul. So it's sort of like having your soul amputated, but having no phantom feeling of amputation. You've achieved the most. Now, one of the things is that looking at the system, so if we look at the global conveyor belt system, but looking at the system of, hang on, how come if you're still listening to this podcast, you are a champion. Go and make yourself a cup of tea, or if you're in Germany, go and drink some schnapps or something like that, and Ukraine or whatever it is, just break open a bottle of vodka to say, oh yeah, I survived listening to this so far. But the real system is that we are discovering a bit about how the global environment works, and in doing that, we've gone through this path. We're coming back and saying, we know this phenomena that is related to this. We are beginning to turn Earth, the test tube Earth, into a laboratory, and we are going through the process of doing the measurements, and we are trying to work out how to connect to our consciousness to actually bring forward. So the entire aspect of capitalism is that you sell a vision of how to invest money, and you create a profit center in future and create a monopoly of first market mover. And so you get this entire idea of selling a future vision, and that allows you to get money, borrow money, which you can then make money and then pay the person back. This entire aspect of capitalism, we're really trying to do the same sort of thing. We're trying to actually develop the future, put a pitch to the human race, and get them to invest but sort of breaking some things, and we yet haven't found a disruptive technology. One of the people thinking of saying, oh, look, if we have a Pacific Island go out to seas, that might be disruptive. I doubt it. It's in terms of people become inoculated to environment. We can't actually get the planet. We can't actually educate the dumbest people by wrecking the planet and saying, now do you believe me? We're all going to die. Oh, no. I told you all along. They'll just swap, or they'll always be on side. No, it requires a sophisticated system to actually try and look at the feedback loops in the current education system and just quietly get up a system which is running more effectively side by side, and over time have this investment, technology investment philosophy that is, that we have this idea of podcasts, quizzes, community education focus groups, which obviously it can't. This I think Einstein said we can't solve a problem using the same level of thinking that created the problem or presented the problem. And so similarly here, we've got to go up a path. So what I've done here, now there's yet another set of experiments to make a hydrosphere system to go ahead. I won't do it tonight, because I think this is a nice little package which is actually built understanding by interaction of the global conveyor, some weather issues, and has built also the actual class as a functioning experiment. People are taught to experiment not on something, but with their knowledge, and to develop a system of learning rather than receiving learning and going ahead. They've got to go up and produce them. And this, I think, is indeed the way forward to go through it. So coming up next, and possibly other episodes, are building a water cycle. An experiment to produce a lovely little water cycle, and some of the decision economics of going solar and renewable about set points. I can see some very disruptive, game-changing set points that were like we're strategically, this is sort of like a big picture. This is the danger thing. We're sort of investing in our kiddies. So sort of like showing them the world's worst drivers, you know, stuff like that. And they go, hang on, that's the way mum's driving. Oh, no. And they get really nervous in the car. Perhaps that may change. I don't think it will really go ahead. It will definitely go along with that process. Now, the aim that I'm really interested in is that there can be deployment of renewables in ways which are systemically disruptive to the coal model. It's like the coal model is allowing us to do certain things. As we cross certain thresholds for expense, like there is a price point on solar cells, which means that we can actually overcome some various limitations and various ideas. we can actually really move ahead. So I might have that as a separate discussion from education. So another education discussion about the water cycle, and another one where I discuss there must be some sort of dam out there. That's incredible. Oh, this would be Woody Pear Dam. Is that right? I just have a... Look, I've been walking for hours. I'm sure this is going across here. So I can hear... You can hear the frogs and stuff like that. I look down. Like, I've been walking for hours and I've got to be much further up. I just have to look. Because you can hear the frogs. So you can basically find water anywhere in the bush. It says Woody Pear Dam. Fire for fighting purposes only, i.e. quote unquote, there's buckets of leeches. you can hear that sort of thing. Okay, so there is this plan afoot that is looking at the spreadsheets. There's a price point where you can see solar can go disruptive, and where it's probably worth investing to get in on business models which exploit this disruption. That is, if something's happening, you can trigger it a little bit faster. And I can. This is just from my MBA, business finance. So I'll discuss that future. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.